Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Monday morning. It's August 5th. 65 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. We've got 66 degrees in Heber City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Happy Monday to you as we get ready to kind of kick off a new work week and get the week started. We are looking at sunshine, but dangerous heat. That's going to be the big story. We were talking about this last week, that temperatures are going to spike heading into the weekend and especially the beginning of this week. And so, yes, even up towards Park City, we're looking at temperatures getting into the low 90s. In Heber, we're looking at those temperatures getting into the upper 90s, the triple digits over the next couple of days. In fact, we could near 101, 102 in Heber City there as we get towards tomorrow afternoon. So it is going to be sunny. It's going to be hot. That's going to be some dangerous heat. So make sure you are taking your heat precautions very seriously as we go throughout that time. Of course, we want you to stay hydrated. Make sure you're drinking plenty of water, replacing those electrolytes throughout the day. Don't wait until you're thirsty, because by that time it's a little late because you're already dehydrated. So make sure that you're doing that ahead of time to keep up with this heat, as you are going to be out there sweating, especially for those who are going to be having to work outside during this dangerous heat. As far as rain chances go, we will have a chance of a few pop-up showers and storms as we go into the afternoon hours. It's going to be a low-end chance, but there will be a chance that we could get a quick downpour, a little bit of lightning out there. So be aware of that, and that will be the story going into your Tuesday as well. But overall, we start to lose the chance of rain as we get towards Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and temperatures will stay on the warm side, upper 90s to around 100 in the Heber Valley. And then as you get up towards the higher elevations, temperatures still right around 90 to lower 90s. And that's going to be the story with us through most of the week. Now, as we head towards this weekend, that's when we're going to start to track some potential changes moving our way. We're going to be seeing this high pressure trying to, we'll call it, flatten out just a little bit. And as it does so, it may allow for a little bit of a dip in the jet stream. And if that occurs, that will allow for some slightly cooler temperatures to work its way into the area. So instead of talking about temperatures in the upper 90s to around 100, we may be talking temperatures in the upper 80s to low 90s across the area, which is, yes, about 10 degrees cooler than where it has been. But that would just get us back closer to normal for this time of the year. But, hey, we'll take it. The other thing to that will be a southwesterly flow that will kick in, and that will help bring us a little bit more moisture. So we'll see a better chance of some scattered showers and downpours moving in across the area as well as we get towards this weekend. So cooler temperatures, better rain chances this weekend will be nice. But before we get there, of course, we've got to get through the first half of this week, and it's going to be all about that dangerous heat. Again, in the higher elevations, we're talking temperatures climbing into the low to mid 90s. But yeah, if you're in the valley areas like the Heber Valley area, we're going to be looking at temperatures in the upper 90s to low 100s for the next couple of days. So dangerous heat. Be aware of that for any of your outdoor activities, Leslie. So we've got a hot start to the week, but some nicer changes, I think, by the weekend.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Cedric.
No, thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be introducing you to Summit County's new security chief, Lieutenant Todd Davis, Chief Deputy Casey Bates, with an update on some of the increased call volumes for search and rescues that we're seeing. Later on, Heber City Councilmember Aaron Cheatwood will be previewing Tuesday's City Council meeting. And finally, this hour, Editor-in-Chief of National Parks Traveler, Kurt Repinchek, is joined by his special projects editor, Pat Cohn. Will be telling us a little bit more about this nonprofit website that covers the national parks and some of the projects that they're working on. Taking a look at some local news now, the 55th annual Kimball Arts Festival is known for lining Park City's Main Street with hundreds of artists. As KPCW's Christine Weller reports, the festival also fosters a love of art in visiting kids.
This year's Kimball Arts Festival featured work from almost 200 jury-selected artists in 13 categories, including ceramics, sculpture, and glass. Throughout the three-day event, white tents filled with different styles of art dot Main Street from top to bottom. Visitors come by the hundreds each day to wander the booths, marvel at the creativity of artists, and, in some cases, scoop up the must-have pieces that catch their eye. But it's also a place to be inspired, with interactive stations and outdoor spaces that allow people of all ages to tap into their creativity. At the Creation Station on Townlift Plaza Saturday, Emma Lynch from the Kimball Arts Center said around 600 people try their hand at making festival-inspired crafts throughout the event.
It really adds to the festival that you can be inspired by artists on the street and then get your chance at your own hands-on art making.
8-year-old Carly Baldwin was there decorating a Boredom bag with bright hues of purple and orange.
A Boredom bag is when you're bored, you can pull out a stick and it gives you ideas what you can do when you're bored.
Carly said one idea she's adding in her Boredom bag is to read a book. She drew a special lamp on the bag.
Because I love lamps.
At the same time Carly was filling her bag with ideas, Byron Jansen was at a nearby table making window art, which mimics stained glass. His piece looked like a turtle.
I just thought it would be fun to make a turtle.
The festival also featured an outdoor pottery making station called Studio on Main. It's an extension of a year-round program at the Kimball Arts Center, teaching kids of all ages to throw clay on a pottery wheel or build a piece with their hands. Hunter Curry, a teacher at the station, said Studio on Main is meant to make pottery more accessible to a broader audience. He says around 200 people dirty their hands with clay to create something during the festival. A member of the Kimball Arts Center coached Quindry Pass through making his first bowl on a pottery wheel.
It was pretty fun. I feel like I would have messed it up. He was good at like walking me through how to hold my hands properly and press it out.
Studio on Main, Quindry said, was a great way to introduce kids to pottery and get them to be creative. Quindry's cousin, Braden Berker, also learned how to use the pottery wheel.
I think it was really fun because it's such a new experience, and it's like I never really thought that I would have enjoyed it that much, but I did.
The Kimball Arts Festival is one of the top-ranked art festivals in the country because of interactive aspects like these, which foster creativity. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The Summit County Sheriff's Office has hired a new security chief. That's Lieutenant Todd Davis. He joins me in the studio along with Chief Deputy Casey Bates. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Leslie.
Lieutenant Davis, maybe just start by telling us a little bit about yourself. Have you been with the Sheriff's Department? And then this is a job that you've applied for then?
Yes, kind of. So I've been with Summit County for about 10 years now. Prior to that, I worked for 8 years down in the Salt Lake area as a law enforcement officer. This position was newly created by the Sheriff's Office to be in compliance with the new House bill that was passed earlier this year that required all counties to appoint a school security chief per county. And so this is one that was created, and the sheriff has taken this as a very important position and so created this to be a standalone position to handle kind of a liaison with the schools and coordinate school security with them.
Okay, so what is it that you're responsible for?
So essentially, I'm going to be the liaison with most of the school districts handling individual school security, coordinating with each school should have a school security specialist that they've assigned. Kind of coordinating with them, doing school safety assessments, going through a lot of checklists as far as some of the safety protocol that's in place at each school, as well as training what's called the Guardian program that was spelled out in that bill. Essentially, that's training people who are assigned to be armed people in the schools that are responsible for school safety. So I have to come up with the training curriculum for them, whether that be a school resource officer or private security that schools have hired or even a volunteer position. This job entails the training curriculum for them in firearms, de-escalation, use of force, case law, that kind of stuff.
Okay, so what is it that, I mean, you kind of go in, you're not there, you're just kind of the trainer. They've got the school resource officer who's there kind
Correct.
Of looking for situations?
Yes, most schools, in fact, kind of depending on how this next year goes, we're trying to get a school resource officer in most of the public schools for sure. Some of the charter schools and then private schools are kind of up to them, up on their own. They're on their own for figuring out kind of how they want to handle security. There are a few requirements in this bill that private schools have to comply with as well. But the Guardian one isn't one that private schools actually have to follow.
So what schools are you responsible for doing all of this training? I mean, is it every school in Summit County or is it just
Yes.
within the kind of unincorporated areas?
No, every school within Summit County. Now, Park City only has a couple of public and charter schools in the city boundaries. They've got a few other private schools. But every school within the county is what the House bill says is that I'm responsible for.
Okay, so you would go to winter sports school, yes, as well as Park City High School.
Yes, Wyloming, yeah, which is a charter school, all the public schools. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, also liaison with some of the private schools, like the Montessori schools and some of the other ones there, and just help them through with the school assessment, whatever safety or security needs that they may have.
Yeah, I just saw a story, I think it was in the Salt Lake Tribune, just talking about all of the money that was just awarded to school districts across the state. And that was because they had to prepare a safety plan. I mean, yes, this was the money for bulletproof glass and things like that. So sounds like they've kind of put the cart before the horse here. I mean, that's something you should have probably been helping them do.
Well, and that's part of it, is we actually have to have a school safety assessment done by the end of the year for all of the schools in the county, which kind of will spell out maybe some deficiencies, you know, locks, security cameras, tinting on the windows, or whatever the case is by school, like on a school-by-school basis, to kind of see maybe what that money is best used for each school.
So you're talking about the year, the end of 2024, as opposed to the end of the 24-25 school year?
Correct. By December 31st, that school safety assessment has to be done and turned into the state. That's the first deadline that we have from that bill.
All right. When did you start?
As the school safety, yeah, chief, about a month ago.
Okay. So that's a lot of schools to get through.
It is, yeah.
A little bit of time.
Yep.
What are you kind of finding out there?
You know, a lot of the schools have already done school safety assessments the previous year. The state hasn't officially released their curriculum for that assessment. I would imagine it's going to be very similar to what they did the previous year. So I think the majority of the schools will have 80% of that assessment done based off of what they've done in previous years. But until we get that official curriculum from the state, we won't know that for sure.
Yeah, well, it doesn't leave you a lot of time.
No, it does, and that's sometimes that's the way it goes, I suppose.
Yeah, probably easier to do it, though, while school's not in session, too, huh?
Yes and no. So the school safety coordinator at each school shouldn't be a teacher, at least, so they shouldn't have that primary responsibility of being in the classroom, you know, vice principals, counselors, or whoever. So during school, might be actually a little bit easier because they will actually be physically at the school. That's kind of what I've found out this summer, is obviously school administration, they don't want to be working either during the summer, so a lot of them have been absent, but in the next week or two, I've talked to several of them, and once they get back into school, I'll go visit them in person, and we'll kind of start working through some of the safety assessment requirements.
Okay, so how are you prioritizing your work?
That's the main thing that I'm working on right now, is the safety assessments, yeah, and just coordinating with all the school safety specialists. That way, that's the only thing that we have a drop-dead deadline on, which is December 31st, to get those assessments in. And then we'll start working on some other components of the bill that have some requirements in them. But there's no specific deadline for those yet. So the school safety assessments are kind of our first priority.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to tell us about that?
No, I don't think so. I'm happy to answer any questions, obviously. But that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it right now.
All right. Well, Casey, let's turn to you and get an update on some other issues. I just wanted to give an update also from somebody who just texted me. I appreciate that. So the traffic backup. The problem is the off-ramp has lane construction going on, and there's only one lane open. Work being done on the bridge. We have heard about traffic backup from people coming from Heber City into the Park City exit with traffic backed up the hill. So it sounds like traffic could be a mess for a little bit. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you texting that in. So, Casey, let's get an update on some of the other issues. What's the latest on the Peoa shootings? I mean, is this, we've got charges filed. I mean, is this going to trial here or court or?
So yeah, right now they're in the adjudication process. This is with the county attorney's office right now. We have arrested all of the individuals that were involved in the incident. And right now they're going through the court process and we'll wait to see what happens.
Yeah, what about the property owner?
I don't know much about the property owner. I would say, like, I know a lot of people rent out their houses, and I think it's important when you do rent out your house that you know who is renting your house, who is signing up for that Airbnb. I think that if I was to give any suggestions, and I've given this suggestion to him as well, we've met, and I think it's very important, and he also agrees with the importance of knowing who's renting the home, especially those big homes that have a lot of people that are capable of being in them.
Okay. And they were doing what they were allowed to do, the property owner, sounds like. So it's like they're not complicit in any of this?
Yeah, they had the Airbnb and everything was fine. I just think that that was a learning lesson for that property owner, that you need to be very diligent in knowing who is contacting you and renting your property.
All right. Sounds like all of the fires in Summit County are out?
Currently, yes. Yes, we had, you know, as everyone knew, we had 3 fires in 4 days on 248 in Browns Canyon. We had one in Echo. The ones on 248 in Browns Canyon came really close together, and so we felt it was important with the sheriff's office, the fire chief, and the investigator. When you have these happen so close together, you have to start looking at what is causing this. Do we have someone starting the fires, or is the construction on 248? We all know that there's a lot of construction on 248 in Browns Canyon. Do we need to look at that and have more people there, our deputies? So we got with Highway Patrol. They're going to send people, the commercial vehicle trucks that they have, the investigators. We're going to be looking at that and making sure that that construction equipment is following the rules and making sure that chains aren't dragging, making sure that all of this is happening. So right now there's a parallel investigation that's happening, just to make sure that we know what the cause of the fire is, and we'll go from there.
So we don't know what the cause is at this point?
Not at this time. That we had the investigator come out, and they took the report and they're sending it in, and we're waiting for the results of that.
Okay. So nothing purposeful, it sounds like, just perhaps accidental.
I believe so at this time.
Fireworks involved?
No.
Okay. Let's see, you're also seeing an uptick in 911 calls. Any idea why? Is it just summertime?
We had actually an uptick in all of our calls. We were up 23% from June on our calls, which is very significant, especially since our dispatch center is down on employees. So they're doing a great job. We actually had, I pulled the number, 1,870 911 calls just in June. We had over 5,000 what we call CAD incidents. Those incidents generate law enforcement response. So that's a lot of responses that we're responding to. And as the sheriff has said, you know, we have 4 and 5 people out just in like our department. We have Highway Patrol, you know, we have all of the surrounding agencies, but we are getting busy. And we were 10% busier this June than we were in 23 on those calls.
Yeah, so what are the calls about?
So some of them are administration, obviously. I do have that number. We had 7,200 administration calls. So those are calls that are people calling in to tell us things, kind of like just your text messages, you know, that you just got. They're asking for our detectives. They're asking for our administration. But the 5,000 CAD incidents are accidents. They're people calling in for citizens assist. They're anything. They range from anything that we respond to. And so those are creating responses from our law enforcement.
So is that 5,000 year to date, or is that 5,000 just for June?
Just for June.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then it's, I guess, Tez, the season as well. Sounds like a lot of search and rescue has also been pretty busy, huh?
Yeah, we've been seeing an increase. We had actually 21 SAR events since June 1st, which is an increase. 16 calls for service, so that means that our search and rescue got called out. What we're seeing is we want people to call in when they can't get a hold of their loved ones, but we also are finding that the information that they have isn't up to date, or they've lost contact for like 1 or 2 hours. So I think it's important to stress that when you go up into the mountains, you're not going to have contact with your loved ones. We have the inreaches, we have other sources that use satellite, but we need to make sure that we give people down with service the ability to know what's happening, like how long you're going to be gone, how long you plan to be where you're going to be. Some of the calls that we're receiving, we are going up and the individual isn't lost. They're sitting there camping and they said, no, I'm not supposed to be back until tomorrow. We had one just on Saturday where somebody walked off and the family wasn't quite sure how familiar they were with the territory, but we got up there and everything was fine. So, you know, some of the calls that we're going to, we're finding that they're probably resolved within 1 or 2 hours. So we're getting an increase, but we want to make sure that we make sure that people know where we're going, how long we're gonna be gone. And that's basically really important, is like the location, because as we know, the Uintas are massive. And so it's important to do that.
Okay. Put a plan together.
Yeah, make a plan.
What about the Tesla, the Glock owner who pointed a gun in a road rage incident? Has that person ever been charged?
That was a highway patrol case, and I do not know about that case. I apologize. I tried to get some information, and that I was not able to get that.
And then Summit County Sheriff also put out looking for help in identifying the driver of the hit and run that happened on SR 32 last week.
I also looked that up because you asked me about it, and I think there needs to be some clarification with this. I talked to the prosecutor's office, which has that case now. That initially was a highway patrol case, but the prosecutor's office has it, so I talked to the prosecutor. This wasn't a hit and run. This was actually the individual that was involved in the incident stayed there. We have one witness that stopped and made sure the person was okay, but we have a second witness that stopped and did not remain on scene. And so that is what we're looking for, is that second witness that didn't remain on scene, that has information for the county attorney's office.
Okay, so that may have been, they thought that since there was already a witness, they didn't need to be there?
That is the understanding. And so we're reaching out. The county attorney's office asked us to put that out. And as the article states, it's an individual that was driving a gold or tan midsize vehicle. And they stopped, saw that there was another witness. I believe they said that they had to go to work, and so they left. And so the county attorney's office is just wanting to speak with that individual. If anybody knows who that is, or please contact the county attorney's office.
Okay, so what are the rules for that? Do you have to, if you've seen something, do you have to stay?
So being a witness at an accident, you're an important part of the investigation. You have important facts with the investigation, and law enforcement would absolutely love you to stay and write a witness statement so that we have more information, more eyes that have seen stuff, and have that information helps with our investigations. And so it is important. It's extremely important to stay if you're a witness, to talk to the law enforcement officer before you leave the scene.
Okay, and real quick, you wanted to mention that you've got a community outreach program happening.
Just to end, I mean, if we're doing that, our community outreach program is doing excellent. We've handed out hundreds of informational pamphlets and handouts. Our deputy, Daniela Anderson, is taking charge of this. We have another driver's license class August 10th at the Richens Building. We're talking about implied consent laws. We're talking about DUIs. We're talking about driver's licenses, fraud. And it's become so popular that we actually have people coming from out of our county to come to these workshops.
Okay, so when and where?
So it's August 10th, and I believe it's at the Richens Building. And we will post that to talk about the time. I'm not sure about the time.
Okay, anything else you want to mention?
Just a couple things. We have the Citizens Academy graduation this week, so we're ending that. Sergeant Talbot has done an amazing job with that, and we are happy to be having that graduation and on Tuesday night. And just as you were talking earlier about the Summit County Fair, that's happening this week, and we would love everyone to go to that.
Okay. Casey Bates, Todd Davis, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The Heber City Council meets on Tuesday starting at 4 o'clock in work session. On the phone with a meeting preview as well as a city update, I have Heber City Council member Aaron Cheatwood. Thanks for joining us. Good morning.
You're welcome. Great to be here.
Yeah, so first up on the agenda tomorrow is a two one-hour long discussions. First by City Manager Matt Brower about his trip to Caldwell, Idaho. Can you just tell us why the council authorized this visit to Idaho? I mean, what did he go to find out?
Yeah, for sure. Regrettably, I wasn't able to go to the trip, but Matt was able to go. A couple other people from the council and from the planning commission were able to go. And really what we're doing is looking at Caldwell and looking at their downtown, kind of how they are using the downtown to manage events and to invite the residents to, you know, to a centralized space, kind of this living room of the city concept, to be able to see there and be together and do things as a community. We're looking at them and trying to learn from them about how it is that they've kind of curbed and created that area to be right in the downtown. So they're looking at things like, you know, the events that they have going, how they're policing the events, how they're marketing the events, how they're keeping the community engaged and raising awareness about events. And just, you know, we're looking at that as an opportunity to refine our development strategy with the downtown, specifically with how we keep people engaged and coming out to events.
So I guess why Caldwell? I mean, you could have gone to any kind of Main Street, no?
Yeah, they have gone to a couple of ones. You know, regrettably, in the 7 months I've been in, they haven't been to any other than this one. But they did go to a city in Colorado, I want to say 2 years ago. You're right, they could go to different cities. You know, we've got a great example in some ways of, you know, in Park City, for instance. We've got good examples in other cities. You know, maybe we go a little further up, go to Logan or see how St. George is dealing with some of their events and some of their public, you know, participation and things like that. Caldwell was just a great instance of a couple of different things we wanted to see. Roger Brooks is somebody we've done some consulting work over time with, and that was something that he recommended. And it was a relatively quick trip for the couple of people that were able to go out there and see what they saw.
Okay.
It'll be a good discussion.
And then the second hour-long discussion, the council will hear from Community Development Director Tony Kohler along with Planning Consultant John Jansen with an update on the draft Central Heber Overlay Zone Code. This is in a joint meeting with the Planning Commission. So what did the city hire a consultant to do here?
Basically what we're looking at is, you know, if we look back in time, the city's put a lot of work into the Envision 2050 plan and what that means for the city going forward. So what it means for development, what it means for activities, what it means for zonage, and what it means for different areas of the city. And really the reality is we're now in the phase where that, you know, the public support came, that plan was written and has been adopted. And now we have to make sure that it actually gets into place, that all of these different areas of town start to see zoning changes that allow them to become what the city and what the public wanted them to become. So what we're looking at here, and Tony will walk us through, is help us to understand with these couple of overlay zones right now that don't really fit the plan. In other words, they don't fit what the public wanted to see in those areas of town. These are the changes that are going to have to come into place so that things can fit the envisioned plan. You know, you'll see a couple of different areas in there that are changes. So we've got a big overlay zone right now that effectively is from 500 East to 500 West. There's going to be some changes there. There's going to be some changes in what's recommended and what's allowed on the way into Midway, so kind of that Midway Lane area. And it's just trying to put into actual practice what the public voice opinions on and what has already been adopted in the kind of greater general plan and the Envision 2050 plan. This is going to be a great discussion as well. I encourage people to join in, ask questions, or at least watch and see what the presentation is.
Yeah, certainly on social media, critics of development in Heber questioning how the council does business. They would say that developers come in with extraordinary density requests and then negotiate down from there, but getting really what they wanted all along and then still requiring an exception. So I guess the problem they say is that the council approves these exceptions. So why not just stick to the code? If the application doesn't come into code, ask the applicant to amend it so it does.
Yeah, that's a great question, Leslie. The reality is we do see a lot of things that are slightly out of code or that would require exceptions, and we do actually say no to a lot of them. we'll stop it and we'll have a developer come back with a revised plan, take into account things that we actually want to see. Or sometimes we'll actually use those as opportunities to consider if the code is doing what we actually want it to do. And sometimes it isn't, actually. You know, we'll look and we'll see the code and we'll think what we actually wanted out of the code. And then reality is when the developer goes to try to make that work, it actually doesn't work. We didn't think through the wording that well. And that's part of just what the cities have to do, is going back and thinking about how things can change. But something that's really important, and I wish I had a better voice to tell the public this, when a developer comes forward to us with a change or they want to see something that doesn't fit with the code, that's really important. That isn't the city automatically saying, listen, we're in favor of this change. We're in favor of going against code or going beyond code in these ways. It has to come forward to a meeting. It has to come forward where we can talk about it. One, it gives us the chance to say no. Two, it gives us the chance to come back and to refine or redefine what it is that we're actually trying to get done and make sure developers actually hear us and understand, which is important so we can give examples to other developers. And then three, it gives us a chance to have that conversation and to hear from the public and give the public a chance to come in. So, you know, you're right. Social media sometimes is rough. And I take a big portion of the social media comments as far as just being online and trying to be engaged with the public. It's something I committed to when I ran for office, something I continue to stay committed with. But sometimes those can get those comments can get a little nasty. And, you know, there's a lot of accusations. And the reality is, seeing something on an agenda does not mean the council is in favor or against that item. It just means that it's coming forward for discussion. And developers, anytime they want to go beyond or against code, they need to come in and they need to ask. You're right. Sometimes it's important to make sure we stick to the code and we don't make any changes. Well, sometimes, though, the changes do make sense.
Yeah, so will this overlay then prevent the need then for these special exceptions? Because, again, the critics will say that these special exceptions are what's going to come to bite the city, you know, legally. Because it's like, if you do this for this person, then you've got to do it for the people who come again.
Yeah, later. That's a great point. You know, the reality with the overlay changes and things like that is we're trying to head off special exception. It's one of the things that I have brought up a couple of times recently in council. The more special one-off exceptions, frankly, the harder it is to manage. And you just kind of hit on that. Not only is it hard to manage from, you know, he got this, I didn't, she got this, I didn't kind of mentality, but it's also just hard to manage. There's just, you know, if every development has its own rules, it's tough. We're trying our best to put into place overlay changes and zoning changes that don't require seeing developers all the time with overlay, you know, with overages or changes. We're trying our best to get the zoning into a place where developers understand and people that want to change and build understand in advance what's allowed and what's kind of in the vision. And so they just stop coming forward with things that don't fit the vision. And there have been a few developers recently that have come forward and we have said that doesn't fit in that area. That doesn't fit the vision. That doesn't fit what we want to see there, and they've left empty-handed, for lack of a better word.
You've got a Truth and Taxation public hearing coming up later this month. When and where is that going to happen?
Yep, Truth and Taxation is going to be a really important meeting. If I'm correct, I'm pretty sure it's the 20th, although I should probably check that date. It's the 20th. It'll be at 7 o'clock, and that is really important. And any times that there's a change in the taxation, there needs to be a Truth in Taxation hearing. We do encourage, and I encourage especially anybody that wants to be heard, to come to that meeting to look at the budget items, look at the things that are on the agenda. If you have issues or things you want to be heard on, or changes you suggest for the city, things that we should consider funding or not funding, please come and say something about it. We hear a lot of things on social media you hit on earlier. We hear through the grapevine and you know, at the store and whatnot, but we just don't have a whole lot of public attendance to these meetings. And I really wish people would come either digitally or in person and just let us know what they're thinking, let us know what they're feeling. This is largely about budget approvals for the year, and I think there'll be some good conversations there. I would encourage anybody that has questions or thoughts to go back and review the previous two budget meetings, because there was a lot of great discussion about some of those line items, why some of them went up, why some of them went down, what we cut already, what we feel like we can't cut, and what's important to the city there.
Yeah. So how much are taxes proposed to go up?
If they do go up, I want to say we looked at the The totals, shoot, I, you know, Leslie, I don't have the specific one. I want to say that with the median housing, it was something in the neighborhood of $30 a month or $30 a year, based on the changes that were in there. Okay. I'm trying to find that, and I think I'm going to fail in the time I've got.
That's all right. So is new growth then paying its own way? And if it's not, why do we continue to approve it or require it that it does pay its own way? Because what you're doing here is that you're adding services now for more people, which costs more. So are they paying their own way?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the reality is a lot of the infrastructure changes and things that we need to see in order to make the city continue to be successful do come from things like impact fees and, like you said, paying their own way. There's a lot coming, and I think that's a unique and a tricky balance to understand when those infrastructure changes need to come in, with the reality that the growth doesn't all come at one time. So take any of the approved housing or approved development things that have come through in the last 5 to 10 years. Some of them are built out all the way, some of them aren't, and some of them are entitled to build over the next 15, 20, 30 years. That's tough, right? As they build out, you know, the reach for the amenities, the reach for the infrastructure is further out. And the reality is we don't have all of the tax revenue or all of the income coming in sometimes to balance that. That is a tricky thing, and it's something we consider every time we meet, especially every time we talk about budgets. We do try, though, to make sure that people are paying their own way. We do definitely try to make sure that the entitlements and things that come from the county and come from the state are considered, but that city has a seat at the table in thinking about what things will best serve the city as far as where the roads need to go, where key road interactions, utilities, things like that need to go. We are always thinking about snow removal, for instance, and parking and things that will make it a good place to live and a safe place to live. You know, and it's something we hear and see from the public that is really important to them as far as traffic and water supply and things like, you know, safety, things like that.
All right. I just quickly, the council also expected an update on the multi-million-dollar waterline replacement project. Will this phase be complete in time for the start of school?
Boy, we sure hope so. We have tried our best to do that. And the reality is this phase, specifically 500 North and then those connecting roads, which is kind of the last part of what we could get funded and get done this summer. You know, it's definitely impacting to the residents here. It's hard to get into that area, and it certainly didn't work out exactly like we planned as far as when that road was going to be closed. We hoped that northern road north of the new Smith building would be open. It wasn't quite open. We hoped that some of these roundabouts would be open. They weren't quite open, but we were very, very strong of the opinion that we want to make sure all of that is wrapped up before there are kids walking on that road to and from school. It's one thing to inconvenience adults in a car that have to go around. It's a completely other thing to have heavy machinery operating next to children that are walking to school. And we do not want that to happen. They are pushing hard to get that done. And I think they are going to be done. They've committed to be done. I don't see any reason that it won't be.
Okay. I'm out of time. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome. Great to be here.
Over the last 20 years, the American news industry has been shrinking and newspapers falling by the wayside. Here locally, an effort to make sure that coverage remains on one of the country's most important assets, our national parks, continues. In the studio, I have journalist, author, and the founder of the National Park Traveler, Park City resident Kurt Repincheck. He's joined by former Summit County Commissioner and award-winning photographer Pat Cohn, who serves as the Traveler's Special Project Editor. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Kurt, let's start with you. Maybe just tell us, when did you start the National Park Traveler?
You know, it was 19 years ago this month. So we're celebrating our 19th anniversary and moving into our 20th year.
Yeah, well, congratulations on that. So why did it something that you thought was necessary?
You know, it started out as just a way for me to find story ideas to pitch to the magazine world. And just about the same time I'd launched the Traveler, the magazine world kind of cratered. The dot-com boom was starting to take a lot of strength and starting to take a lot of advertising and editorial windows away from hardcover magazines. But at the same time, readership in the Traveler kept accelerating. And so I figured, you know, there's a niche out there that needs to be filled.
Yeah, so it's a nonprofit organization. You're funded by what, donations and grants?
Donations largely, some advertising. Chasing grants is something we do. We haven't caught any yet. It's a really hard niche to get into in terms of grants.
Yeah, so have you been able, though, to make more money then by selling the what you're creating and putting it into a magazine? Or
you know, we're getting a lot more support from the readership and our listeners. We do a weekly podcast as well. There was a story in National Parks Conservation Association magazine this past March that raised the attention of the traveler and the situation we were in. I tried to retire twice in the past 6 months, Leslie, and each time the readers stepped up and donated enough money to keep us going. And we did get a nice donation that really has helped us move forward. It doesn't solve the problem. We're still underfunded because one person can't do this, especially for the rest of my life, because I don't have too many years left, I don't know. But there's a real interest in National Park News.
Yeah, and that's kind of like one of my questions. Is there really enough National Park News to keep busy?
You know, my one son, Jesse, asked me that some years ago, and it's been over 14 years since he asked me that. There is so much news out there, Leslie, you can't imagine. I mean, there's the typical hard news that comes across, like fires in the Northwest that are shutting down some national parks. There's the Hurricane Debbie that has shut down some national parks in Florida and Georgia. But beyond that, there's the issues before Congress and before the National Park Service leadership. We had a story yesterday about the decline in law enforcement rangers. I mean, unless you're a real park nerd, you know, you may not know the difference between an interpretive ranger and a law enforcement ranger, but it's the law enforcement rangers who keep the visitors safe, who protect the natural resources in the national park system, and their ranks are really declining. I think this past year, 2023, the Park Service was able to hire just 45 seasonal law enforcement rangers, where in 2022, I think it was over 300. So funding is going down, they're losing law enforcement rangers. That's just one example of the need for this type of coverage to keep the people who love national parks aware of how their parks are being managed.
Yeah, and so are you able to get out to the parks, or do you have to kind of cover it from Summit County?
Not as much as I'd like to. We've got a network of stringers across the country, pretty much geographically located. We've got some in California, upstate New York, Arlington, Virginia, Maine. We've got writers all over the country.
How many national parks do we have?
There's over 420. I mean, people think national parks, as in Yellowstone National Park or Arches National Park, there are 63 of those. But when you look at all the national park system, the national monuments, the national historical parks, the national historic sites, there's over 420.
So you're covering all of that?
Yeah.
Not just the parks.
And that's just it. That's the value of the traveler is, you know, the mainstream media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, they'll swoop in when there's a breaking story like the floods in Yellowstone last June. We're out there every day covering the stuff that flies below the national media, but is still important.
Yeah. And so what is it that you do? People could just go on. There's no paywall or anything. And you say you had a weekly podcast. What else is it that you do?
What else is it that we do?
I mean, so it's written content, right?
Yeah. It's written. It's a nonprofit, nationalparkstraveler.org. It's free to get into to read it anywhere in the world. We do a weekly podcast. We're up to 286 weekly podcasts going back to February of 2019. We do special projects, as Pat can attest to.
Okay. Did you guys cover the fact that Powder Core kind of took over a couple of the park concessions?
We did. And I've been in conversations with the staff at Powder Core to sit down with them and get their take on what they're getting into and what they think they can bring to the table.
Yeah, interesting diversification, yeah?
It is very interesting. And, you know, they've told me that, you know, part of the strategy is, you know, they've got this winter workforce that once the snow melts and it goes downstream, you know, they'd like to be able to take that workforce and put them to work someplace else. And, you know, national parks are, you know, staffed largely by seasonal workers at the concessions. And so they're makes sense.
Yeah. Well, Pat, let's talk a little bit about what you do as special projects editor.
Okay. I Well, I basically do, we go on the road with Kurt to national parks. We do travel a fair amount, actually. I do stills and video and write as well. Kurt, I think when he's talking about the 286 podcasts, I think we had something like 750,000 of those downloaded at this point, and a readership over 2 million a year, which is, you know, that's significant numbers. And like you said, we have correspondents all over. We do some worldwide park type things. We're slated to go to Yellowstone tomorrow on a thing on white bark pine. We're stalled on that. We're going to probably have to reschedule that. But I work on series of things right now. There are four of us working on a series on climate change impacts to national park on the eastern seaboard, primarily sea rise type things. I'm working on infrastructure damage and things like that. I did a series on the use of beaver in national parks and how they're increasing riparian areas and attracting wildlife, also acting as fire breaks. So we traveled to Rocky Mountain National Park and Bandolier, New Mexico, and some other places. I've got a story dropping tomorrow on pollinators in the national park, the decline in pollinators, monarch butterflies and bees, and how important they are to everything. So, I get to do the fun stuff. Kurt does the office stuff.
Yeah. All right, so you're writing and photographing.
Absolutely. You got to diversify, adapt or die, you know.
Yeah. The Yellowstone explosion, I mean, I certainly saw it in the headlines. What the heck happened there? Was this Old Faithful?
We were talking to them about going up near there and doing some interviews on that. They're, I think, restricting access to that. I mean, it's a geothermal, geologically active area, and things happen. I mean, you know, it's basically pressure builds up and kapow. Sometimes it's easy and it comes up as water and hot water, but in that case, it was basically plugged up and, you know, this massive explosion happened. It was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it was a hydrothermal explosion about 2 miles northwest of Old Faithful in the Biscuit Basin area. And it was really fortunate because it lofted some boulders that were a couple hundred pounds, and there were people on the boardwalk at the time, and nobody was injured. It was just amazing.
Right. Any way to measure that? I mean, do they kind of have an idea of what's happening?
It's just geologically active areas. You had a lot of hot water under pressure, and then it just kind of flashed into steam and exploded. What was kind of interesting was the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Every week they put out a column called Caldera Chronicles, and it's some aspect about the Yellowstone caldera, the magma, the volcano. And the one for that week was about a smaller hydrothermal explosion in the Norris Geyser Basin, and this was, you know, a couple hundred yards, I think, from the boardwalk, and that was a small one. And then this one happened the very next day. It sent, you know, clouds of steam and mud and water 600 feet in the air. And it's just part of that living volcano. They can't predict when they're going to happen. They can't predict where they're going to happen.
So have you kept track of how many parks you visited? Or monuments, historical areas? Any idea, Pat?
No.
You need to get yourself one of those little passports that they sell at the National Park Store.
I have a hiking stick that's about 7 foot tall, and it's just full of the hiking medallions that I pick up around the system. But, you know, yeah, it'd be nice to go to every single national park in the U.S. park system, let alone the world. But when you realize it goes from the Virgin Islands and the Caribbean to the American Samoa and the Western Pacific, that's a long way to travel.
Yeah, so of those that you've traveled to, do you have a favorite?
Oh, I like the Grand Canyon. I like taking a raft down the Grand Canyon. That's about my favorite thing. I think one thing to mention about Kurt, he's a little shy about this, but he probably has, I don't know how many superintendents on speed dial, and he has connections to the National Park Service like you wouldn't believe. The other thing is we also hold the Park Service to task when they do something that maybe is a little more interesting. So we're a bit of a watchdog when it comes to that, which... you know, I think it's a role that needs to be filled. The other thing that happens is, and Kurt hasn't mentioned this, is we're kind of a dirty little secret for a lot of the mainstream media, like CNN and Washington Post, some of these people. They see stories we run, and they pick them up and run with them. And sometimes they attribute them to us, which is nice. Sometimes they don't. But, you know, it's a good thing. But we do, you know, we do about three original news stories every single day. We're not an aggregate news source. We're not picking up other people's stories. We're sending journalists into the field to get these stories so people can read them.
Okay. How do people find you?
NationalParksTraveler.org.
Okay.
And you can find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We're on iTunes, all the podcast outlets.
Okay. Well, thanks for spending some time with us. Right. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
Leslie.
Kurt Rebenchick and Pat Cohn with the National Parks Traveler.